Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Real spoilers powered by ReviewSTL.com.
Warning, the following film discussion will ruin the ending of any movie you haven't seen. Example, Bruce Willis is dead at the end of The Sixth Sense. See how I ruined it for you? Just like that. Here are a few more.
Silent breed is people!
I am the father.
Get it?
Real spoilers. You've been warned.
Broadcasting from the lush but not lavish studios located in the basement of the O'Keefe Institute for Advanced Film Snarkitude, this is Real Spoilers, episode 583. Once again, we delve into the world of classic films, in this case classic, sometimes merely successful films, and their misbegotten sequels. So this episode, you're in for a treat. Next episode, not so much. Welcome to...
I mean, maybe you are. Maybe it's a garbage movie and it'll be a good episode.
Well, the episode might be good, but the movie won't. Welcome to Rosemary's Baby at your cervix. Believe it or not, I haven't been waiting to tell that joke. It just popped into my head. So
wow.
I guess you could say it's just now crowning. Let's go around the virtual.
These jokes are a little too real for Kevin.
Yeah.
Oh, you're telling me.
So let's go around the virtual table and everyone can introduce themselves.
This is Joe.
This is Kevin.
And this is Tom. Quick shameless plugs. Don't forget we're available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Spreaker, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcasts, you can find us. While you're there, be sure and subscribe so you never miss an episode. And of course, check us out on Facebook, facebook.com/realspoilers. While you're there, like the page, join the group. We had lots of people chiming in last week on the episode, which was nice, and answering my question about if you watch the movies before you listen to an episode or after. So that was nice to see all that feedback and interaction. So you can also become a real honest-to-God League of Show Share member by sharing an episode. People who were kind enough to share an episode this week, Julianne Jordan, Carl Clarkson, Griffin Fox Smith, Librarian Cynthia, Chris Williams, Heather Sachs, Ron Johnson, Gabriel Lugo, John Friedman, Susan Carlson, Chris Magic Man, Chris Sanders, Travis Tewitt, Tammy Sherman Powers, Ralph Tribble, Jason Weese, Lane Levanway, Brent Smith, Chris Falls, and... amazingly, first time ever, new League of Show Share members, ladies and gentlemen, give it up for Gus Boutique.
Oh, wow.
I've only done, you know, how many of these things? And now way to chime in, old man.
500.
He probably shared it and changed his privacy settings so that he could comment on his love of Jay Leno.
I'm not even sure he listens, to be honest.
He didn't have to change his privacy settings because I am Facebook friends with your father. So
Oh, good Lord. That does not bode well for
report
anybody.
Back and tattle on him when Joe says a naughty word.
Yes, I just keep him up to date on your...
Who do you think taught me the naughty words? And the proper usage of them.
Does your father, when he's around your daughters and he needs to cuss, does he cluck like a chicken?
No,
he's
it's
a
weird,
rooster.
Right? Like, he doesn't, so, like, that dude, his mouth, like, that's how I learned how to cuss. Like, that's what it was. Doesn't say a word around the girls. I was like, all right, I see how it works.
When you talk to Joe's dad, he seems like the sweetest, nicest person that would never, like, talk like that.
Oh.
Which is so funny that, like, it just seems so natural for Joe, and apparently he learned it for him. He's very good at covering it up.
I learned it from watching you.
Also, while we're in shameless plugs, don't forget our Patreon, patreon.com/realspoilers, where for $5 a month you get all sorts of bonus content, and you get the joy of helping out. It is joyful for us, maybe not for you, but we appreciate it. So anyway, there's all that. The movie of the week is, or one of the two movies, the franchise of the week is Rosemary's Baby. We should start by at least
weird franchise.
Yeah, we should at least start by addressing the underage sexually assaulted elephant in the room, which is,
you know, it's a shame that he wasn't in the house when the Manson family attacked. That's all I have to say.
He's Roman Polanski, who was charged with the rape of a 13-year-old girl, pled guilty to it. It's not like a did he kind of a thing. It's like, no, he had sex with he had sex with a 13-year-old girl. He's a piece of garbage. The Academy just last year kicked him out. Last year, 2019, yeah. Kicked him out.
And they nominated him, right? Like that he would get nominated all the time.
Oh, sure. He gets nominated all the times. So he won an Oscar for The Pianist in the, what was it, early 2000s?
Yeah. So, well,
for some reason.
He won that well past that being public knowledge. Like, it's not, yeah. Like, I feel like collectively as a society, when someone does something that atrocious, like we almost kind of, historically, and maybe this is shifting, but we've kind of put a marker in time of like, well, the stuff that they worked on before that is different than maybe the stuff they worked on after that.
Yeah.
Right. So it was past Chinatown. So, you know, you don't have to come for Chinatown, or at least you can kind of rationalize that, like Rosemary's Baby, Chinatown, some of those great movies. Okay. They happened before any crime. So, like Tom said, if you're going to rationalize, whatever. But 1977, that is when he committed this atrocious crime, which there's no coming back from that. And Hollywood has continued to support him, work with him, and it's disgusting. So I mean go look at the list of people who've chosen to work with him. I mean, he's got movies in 2019 with actors that surely a lot of us are fans of, you know, and maybe depending on whether or not you know about this, and you know, maybe you do, and maybe, you know, you just separate.
I feel like this isn't like a dark web secret. Like,
no,
this
I mean the actors though. It's like, I mean, maybe you already know that they worked with him. Maybe you don't understand that that they worked with him or whatever. But like Sam Rockwell and Edward Norton just did a movie called An Officer and a Spy in 2019 with charged. I can't say convicted and only not convicted.
No, he's charged and confessed.
But he's not convicted because he fled the country and has been an enemy of the state since 1977. So he can, you know, he can't even come back to the country because he would be thrown in jail. So, but you know, they just worked with him last year. And so I don't know why Hollywood continues to support him and work with him. But like when he won the Oscar.
Gee, could it
for,
be because they all might do similar things and just haven't been caught?
Oh, I mean, I can't speak for all of them. I'm sure there are definitely, I mean, we've found out recently. I mean, if you look at the Weinstein stuff, I mean, there's a lot of sick stuff going on.
Yeah.
But when he just won the Oscar for The Pianist, wasn't that like 2003?
2000. No, that was 2000, wasn't it?
2002.
Oh, okay. Okay.
You know, and you see, you know, Meryl Streep giving him a standing applause, and you know he's not in the country, but they, you know, they announce his name and a picture of him because of course he can't be there, and they're all giving a standing applause. It's just disgusting knowing that it's like, yeah, 30 or 20 years earlier, 20 something years earlier, it's like he had sex with a 13-year-old girl. That's gross.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and it's as recently as 2010 he made Ghost Rider with
Ewan McGregor.
Nicolas Cage?
No. Ghostwriter. With Ewan McGregor, Pierce Brosnan, Kim Cattrall. I believe John Barenthal's in that for a scene as well. And then, what, in 2011 he made Carnage?
Yeah, Carnage stars John C. Reilly, Christoph Waltz, Kate Winslet, and Jodie Foster.
Yeah, I mean, that's...
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's like, it's just gross.
It's
why,
problematic.
What, I mean, okay, he made some good movies. I mean, these are, I mean, we're going to get into one. He made some critically acclaimed movies that are considered some great, great films. But it's like, you want to work with him so bad that you'll just throw away your morals? I don't get it.
No. I agree. I don't have an answer.
It definitely makes me lose respect for these people. I mean, these names that we're reading are actors that I admire. I think they're great actors. A lot of them I'm a fan of. But when they make that choice, you know, I don't know. I don't think there's anything they could really say that, like, you know, what I'm saying is I draw the line at working with them. Like, why would you do that? And no matter what they say, I don't think there's an excuse for that.
I know.
No, there isn't.
I know for a long time there was a narrative about that, like, he fled the country because he had pled guilty and he had a deal in place, and then they rescinded the deal. There was an HBO documentary that they made that was like, you watch the documentary and you're just like, wow, this guy really got a raw deal. And then, like, and I don't think it's available for viewing anymore, because I think like a week after it came out, it was almost entirely debunked as complete BS. They were like, here's the so oh. much. They were, because I remember watching it and being like, oh my God, this guy really, like, he did something bad, but like, he was trying to make amends and he got a bad, and he really got screwed by the system. And then, like, I read this, like, really long article. I don't know where it was at, but it was like Vanity Fair length style article, like, just kind of like picking it apart point by point. And you're just like, whoa. And then HBO was like, yeah, we're going to go ahead and pull that. And I don't know if it's back up or not. I never circled back around to look for it, because at that point I was just like, well, who cares? I mean,
well, of course,
who cares
Hollywood
in terms of hearing his defense?
Clear. They want to work with him, so of course they're going to try to spin it. But, you know, that's the thing. It's like, I don't care what they tried to do to get him. It's like, yeah, he's a fugitive of the country. You want to promise him some kind of a deal if he comes back? Yeah, lie to him. I don't care.
Get him back in the country and put him in jail.
Exactly. It's like, I don't care about that at all. I don't feel sorry for him. I mean, he's been gone now for 40 years. Like, he needs to, I mean, he's never made amends. He's never paid for his crimes. He's never done the jail time. You know, and now it's obviously too late. I mean, he's 86 years old. I mean, how long does he have? I'm just saying,
who cares
if he did come back? Oh, what, he's going to spend he'd probably spend a year in jail, get coronavirus and die. I mean,
okay.
You know, I'm just saying though, it's like, he should have,
I'm not seeing a downside,
but
here.
He should have been in jail since 1977. And at least, I don't know how long the charge would have been, but whatever.
Back then,
he's a white guy in Hollywood.
Yeah. Back then the charges on something like this would have been like 6 months. I mean, they would have.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
You know,
or they would, you know, here's the thing is,
6 months,
know that,
and why,
like,
would you flee the country? Do it and clear, at least do the time, and, you know.
Well, and I might be overstating, but it would not have been a 20-year sentence back then, I don't think.
Okay.
I mean, you'd have a hard time getting a 20-year sentence now. It's not, the system, even though we've made strides, it still doesn't treat sexual assault victims all that kindly.
Gotcha.
Especially when you have deep pockets and really good lawyers. Like,
It's weird how people kind of, as much crap as Once Upon a Time in Hollywood got for the Bruce Lee portrayal, like, there was also kind of an underlying current of how he portrayed Roman Polanski. But it's like, he, in the context of that story, like, he wasn't there. You know, like, he's not.
Oh, and I didn't hear anyone.
There was a little bit of, like, because he wasn't, like, made into, like, a monster.
Yeah.
He was just kind of, like, this dopey little.
But yeah, at that time. But again, like,
he was gone. And,
if,
like,
you're
the one
accurate.
Scene. Right. And the one scene that he has is him sitting outside drinking a cup of coffee, throwing a ball to a dog.
Right.
Just, like, what are you mad about? I don't understand. Like,
what
he
are
you
going
to
do?
You know?
Have him be, look at throwing a ball to a dog and then looking at a photo of a 13-year-old.
Right.
I mean, what are you going to?
Or he's in the house, right? Like, that's the twist at the end of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Is he's in the house too? I don't know.
Yeah,
but it's like,
you know what?
What are you going
to
do?
If you're going to change history, it might have been kind of nice to have him be.
Let them pull his guts out.
Yeah.
But
so anyway, Rosemary's Baby.
Yeah, we just want to acknowledge the fact that we know that the director of this film is problematic, and we don't just want to gloss over that. But the film predates all that, and there's also the element of, like, there's a lot of very talented people that do wonderful work in this film. That's also part of the problem when you start targeting people who have done extremely illegal, wrong, immoral things in something like filmdom is that, but what about all the other people that are involved in the project that now their work can't be seen, or their livelihood is dismissed because of it? It's a very difficult situation to try and navigate.
This is your wrestling corner. It's the Chris Benoit problem, right? Like, Chris Benoit has an awful ending to his story. It's terrible. It's probably, it might be one of the worst in sports, but everything, you know, people are just like, well, he should be in the Hall of Fame based on his in-ring work. It's like, yeah, well, that's fine. And you can go, and the network doesn't edit any of his stuff out. Like, you can go watch a Chris Benoit match if you want. But at the end of the day, he murdered his wife and child. That
yeah, he's
is
not
it.
Going in the Hall of Fame.
No,
like post that. I mean,
right.
That's the thing. So, and to clarify, and we didn't explicitly say this, but what we're saying is that we're not going to go back and try to erase history. We're not going to go back and try to pull this movie from streaming service, and we're not going to try to erase this movie and all that. But it's the decision to work with him going forward,
yeah,
which is
correct.
What is very frustrating and confusing. It's like, so, yeah, people made this movie, and maybe they have residuals, and they did great work in this movie, and it was pre any crime. So it's like, yeah, don't erase history. But it's like, when The Pianist comes out in 2002 and people have known about this for 22 years or 24 years or whatever, the math adds up on the dates, and then you continue to work with him, and then they give him an Oscar, and
right,
you know, it's just like, how do you justify that? And I, again, I don't even care. I don't want to hear it, but you know, it's more rhetorical.
You know, the thing is that if memory serves, the year that he won the Oscar and that, you know, they gave him a standing ovation and you yeah. saw all of Hollywood applauding this guy was the same year that they had some sort of like, there was, maybe it was the Cecil B. DeMille Award or whatever that they give away, but it went to, if memory serves, Elia Kazan, who was basically, he named names to the House Un-American Activities Committee during the McCarthy era, and then after the public opinion of that kind of flipped, he really had difficulty working again, and Hollywood turned on him, and like, every like the good chunk of the room just like sat in stony silence when they were
wow.
addressing him, and which I understand the anger towards him, but then turned around and applauded Polanski. So it's
right.
very problematic. So anyway, enough of all that. We just want to put it out there that we are aware of it, and we're not trying to just pretend like it wasn't a thing. So now let's actually talk about the movie itself, Rosemary's Baby.
I have not seen this in, I mean, decades. I don't usually go back and watch this movie, and it's crazy to see how close this is to both of Ari Aster's movies. Like, so Hereditary and Midsommar, there's a lot of similarities between those two and this. Where
those
are like,
slow burns, just like
they are.
He takes that format to where it's creepy and there's a lot of like unnerving things, but it's not jump scares. It's not the
no.
it's not the classic type of horror where it's just trying to scare you constantly, but you are uneasy by things. And
yeah.
that's why, you know, when I saw those movies, and I've seen this movie before, you know, a while back, but I came to it later. It's not like I watched it when I was 10, but when I eventually watched this movie, you know, I really appreciated how that slow burn, how it was like, it's such a good film. And, mm-hmm. and even if you're not a horror person, because I don't know that this is, I mean,
it's one of those ones that walks that line.
Yeah. Horror, thriller,
you know?
Suspense.
I guess when you're having sex with the devil, that kind of
yeah,
tilts into the horror world.
Given that it all hinges around like a satanic cult that's trying to bring forth the devil in physical form, it's hard not to label it as a horror movie, but
right.
it doesn't use a lot of the elements that you would traditionally associate with horror. There's not much in the way of gore or jump scares or, you know.
There's one really good jump scare in this movie that is so effective because it's the only one.
Yeah. But
so, you know.
But yeah, but it's it really does hold up, and I think work even with a modern sensibility. I mean, maybe
mm-hmm.
more in that realm of art house horror than like if you're coming at it with a Blumhouse mindset, you might be disappointed. But it's weird to say if you like Hereditary or Midsommar, you'll like this because those are clearly influenced by it. But like this. this. It, sometimes you watch an older movie and you almost have to be like, well, they pace things differently. Things felt different then. Like, you got to kind of like put it in historical context and make some apologies for the tone or pacing of the film. And I don't feel like you do at all with this one.
No,
no,
it moves at a good clip. There is pacing, but it's so well done that it doesn't feel like pacing. And what I mean by the hereditary thing is the idea that your main character, everybody that your main character thinks is on their side, is not on their side. Like, every single person that Rosemary encounters in this movie, except for her close friends, are part of this thing.
Yeah,
well, like, yeah. I mean, Hereditary especially. I mean, the pacing and stuff, yeah, you can liken, especially with Midsommar. But, I mean, Hereditary, I don't want to really spoil that movie, but if you're watching
movie. No, yeah.
But I'm just saying Hereditary ends up where you're just like, oh, yeah, Rosemary's Baby is a clear influence on this.
Yeah,
very much so. Yeah. So this movie opens up with Rosemary and Guy, Mia Farrow, and John Cassavetes. Which I was like, oh yeah, this is a guy. Like, he was a massive actor that. I always forget about.
And filmmaker.
Yeah, did you ever see? He talked about working with the guys at Canon, and he's like, I love, you know, Canon is like the, I don't even know how to describe them, like the shysters, if you can use that term. I don't know. Can you use that term?
I don't know. What do you mean?
I don't know. So, like, Canon, the two guys that ran Canon Films were just, like, what's the word? Like, they would pull stuff. They made really bad movies. Really bad movies. And, like, Superman 4 is a Canon feature.
Right.
Masters of the Universe.
Break-In.
Break-In 2, yeah. You know, all that stuff. So, but they... they had John Cassavetes, who at that point I think had kind of not done anything of note, but they just gave him all this money and let him have creative freedom. And he was like, I loved it. I loved working for them. Like, they were amazing to work for because he got to do whatever he wanted because he was John Cassavetes. Mm-hmm. But they would usually give these guys, like, Superman 4 had a shoestring budget, and you're trying to do a Superman movie on a shoestring, it just doesn't work. So, like, if you ever go see Electric Boogaloo, the story of Canon Films. It is astounding to watch, like, how that studio became a thing. Like, they had the rights to Spider-Man at one point, and we're going to make a Spider-Man movie with Tobey Hooper. I don't know. Well, he worked for them towards the end of his career, I think.
And if the name sounds familiar and you don't know John Cassavetes' work, you probably know the work of his son, Nick Cassavetes, who directed The Notebook, which is what really put him on the map.
Yeah. So they, I don't know would you say, Tom, that he's a struggling actor or just like a working actor?
You mean the character or John Cassavetes?
I mean the character Guy. Yeah.
Oh, okay. So I took it as he's like a working actor, but like he's not quite there yet. You know what I mean?
He's doing commercials.
Yeah.
And
like
he's trying
Broadway
to get Broadway's understudy. He's an understudy though. So he's not quite the guy.
He's still searching for his big break.
Yeah.
And Rosemary is just kind of this lovely woman. Like, she's sweet and she's funny. Yeah. And they decide to rent this apartment that this old woman died in. And it's still fully furnished, which is like your first sign that something is wrong, because the apartment is still, everything's still in there, and they've got like, it's such a smart move in a horror movie to like leave clues throughout the movie that will come back around later. So like when they are walking through the apartment, they find like an herb garden. Hey, hold on one second.
Hey! Knock it off!
We'll see if that worked.
I'm talking here.
That was dad and cop voice at the same time.
Oh, boy.
So, yeah, so there's all of these clues throughout the apartment that something isn't right. So they go into and they find the room full of herbs. And it's like, initially you're just like, okay, she was just an old lady who had an herb garden. But as we go forward in the movie, it's like, oh, she didn't just have an herb garden.
Yeah, it's nice. Like, this movie, like it really, like, that, this script works so well just in terms of, like, everything meshes together so beautifully.
Well, and you also, so this was written by Roman Polanski, but adapted by the book by Ira Levin, and apparently Polanski didn't know that you could make changes when adapting
a
book.
Yeah.
And so, like, I literally read that, which sounds odd, but, like, apparently is extremely close to the book. So at least we can give credit to Ira Levin for planting all these details, because...
Yeah, and Ira Levin has written, I mean, he's written some great books. So he wrote this one, obviously. He wrote Boys from Brazil. He wrote The Stepford Wives. He wrote a crime thriller called A Kiss Before Dying, which is so good. So good. And so, I mean, he's written a lot of stuff that's been adapted into big movies.
He wrote
and
Death Trap.
Yeah, that's right. He wrote Death Trap too. Yeah. And, but yeah, like it's funny. Like, I guess this was Polanski's first American film. So he had no idea that when you were adapting a book that like you, that the director could kind of call the shot. So he was like,
faithfully,
he was hyper. Yeah, hyper. Like, there's a point where in the book, Guy mentions wanting to buy a certain shirt that is mentioned in the New Yorker.
Okay.
And Polanski, like, went through back issues trying to find the ad so he could buy the right shirt for him to wear.
Oh, wow.
And Levin was like, it doesn't exist. He's like, I just assumed that, like, any issue of the New Yorker would have an ad for shirts, so like I'm totally winging it.
Oh, that's funny. I would like to know how much time he spent on that, and then I would like to laugh at him for it, because he deserves
it for wasting your
most of the dialogue is in the movie is verbatim from the book.
Like, you know, I mean, you can tell there's a way that things read compared to, like, a movie script, that there's, it sometimes it doesn't work, and I think there that happens in this movie. Like, when the realtor is explaining the apartment, it feels a little weird.
And I think you're not wrong, but I think ultimately it ends up serving the movie well, because it's just from Jump Street, it's just off kilter. Just everything is off kilter, and it kind of helps create this kind of weird, discombobulated world. It also explains why the original cut of this movie was over 4 hours long.
Good Lord.
Yeah.
No, thank you. I don't need it. It's like the director's cut of Midsommar. I don't need to see it.
But so to your point, Joe, so they find, like, they go by a closet, but it's covered with, like, a cabinet or whatever, or they're like, oh wait, there's a closet behind this, why is this in front of a closet, there's something weird going on here, and they see, like, the marks on the ground, so they pull it back and they can open up the closet. There's nothing seemingly wrong there, but later on we find out that there was something going on there.
There's something wrong there.
I want to say one quick thing about the apartment before we move on. This is my version of Wrestling Corner.
Trying
to find my own sound effect.
That's a groovy button. What does it say?
Save the Texas Prairie Chicken.
This apartment is do you remember in the movie Head with the monkeys?
Yeah.
When they have that birthday party and it gets really weird, and, like, they're throwing a birthday party for Mike, and then at the end he's like, and the same thing goes for Christmas too. And they, I think it's the musical scene where they do Can You Dig It? And that is filmed on this set. They used, these movies were filmed at the same time, and they used the Rosemary's Baby apartment set for that particular scene.
I was going to ask if this was a set or this is a real apartment.
So it's the exteriors are a real apartment.
Okay.
But that apartment would not let them film inside. So the interiors are a set. The exteriors, it's a real apartment. It's a very famous apartment, actually, in New York City called the Dakota. And has lots of like very, very, very famous people have lived in the Dakota over the years. So it's like Lauren Bacall and Connie Chung and
Maury Povich,
Judy Garland, John Lennon. So presumably Yoko Ono, John Madden lived there. Joe Namath, Brad Hyen, librarian. No, I'm stealing that. So I forget who it was. Somebody said last week when I was rattling off the band members in the Blues Brothers 2000 Battle of the Bands thing, they said it sounded like the Louis Show series. And I thought that was great. So I totally stole your joke and I apologize. But yeah, Joe Namath, Rosie O'Donnell, Jack Palance, William Inge, who wrote Picnic and Bus Stop, Gilda Radner. But yeah, Maury Povich. Yeah, lots of famous people.
I figure if Connie Chung lived there, that would just kind of go with
yeah,
that.
That's fair. Yeah. In the same way that Yoko Ono, John
exactly.
Lennon, yeah.
So their life is pretty normal. There's also, John Cassavetes isn't nice throughout this. I mean, when we get to the thing, it's like, of course. But like, he's never nice to her. He's always very dismissive and kind of humdrum about his own career, where Mia Farrow's trying to keep this thing going. So like she's helping paint the apartment and they're getting furniture and she's decorating and he comes home like, oh, duh, I suck. And
I also feel like it's kind of a product of the time, though. I just feel like this is how the American husband was portrayed. It was like he's off to work and trying to do his thing, and he comes home and expects his dinner. And, you know,
I feel it's weird. It's sometimes it's difficult to give this movie credit given what Polanski would go on to do.
Sure.
The movie has definitely kind of, I think, a feminist undertone to it in terms of like how poorly this woman is treated, not just from like a satanic rape cult standpoint, obviously, but like everyone around her is so dismissive of her knowledge and her feelings. And like, even like when she goes to the doctor for her pregnancy and she's like, well, I feel this way. No, you don't. Here, take this.
Yeah.
It's like no one ever gives her opinion about what's going on with herself any degree of credibility at any point in this movie. And I don't know if it was as maddening to watch then as it was now, but like
it's
people
super
are just,
frustrating.
People are so dismissive of this woman like from the get-go of it's just like, well, you're just over there to and maybe that's some of the through line they're trying to draw, that maybe society isn't so different than the satanic cult, because they're both just like, well, you're just here to pop out the baby, you're in it means to an end, so just you know your role. Another wrestling.
Yeah, that's very good.
But yeah, it's frustrating because, like Joe set up, Rosemary is such a sweet, nice woman, and she has to deal with all this crap, and people aren't nice, and you know, even her doctor, played by a very young Charles Grodin.
Well, that's the doctor she should have seen.
Right,
Sapper's,
her doctor,
well, that's
like the yeah. original. Yeah, so like, yeah. I mean, but he's not.
Well, no, Charles. Hang on, Charles Grodin doesn't play her OBGYN. He plays her. He just isn't he a psychiatrist?
No,
she
no,
is,
she's she. He,
oh, is that who he was supposed to be? I thought he was going to see like a psychologist.
Uh-uh.
Oh, okay, I misunderstood.
Oh,
well,
I don't want to say like that. I didn't maybe I misunderstood too. Yeah. I knew he was one of her doctors.
No, because he's there. She's the first when she gets pregnant the first time. Well, the first time she finds out she's pregnant, yeah. She's talking to him.
That's
because
what
her friends
yeah.
recommended him.
Yeah,
and then when all hell breaks loose, this high society, quote unquote, which is another fantastic movie if you've never seen that, they kind of say go to Saperstein, and then so she leaves the doctor she wanted and goes to see Saperstein,
and it's very confusing as a fan of pop culture who has weird things stick in his head, because Abe Saperstein spelled differently. But is also the name of the original owner of the Harlem Globetrotters. So
yeah,
maybe that's a red flag for the
do with that what you will. So, but yeah, this was Charles Grodin's like first. This was his breakout role up to up to this point. He had just been like, you know, one or two lines in a movie or
I forgot he was in it.
Well,
I did too.
Apparently, he came to visit the set, and that's where Polanski hired him on the spot. Like, he was doing a set visit, and I think he was like, he was
dressed up as a cowboy.
Yeah, he was dressed up as a cowboy. Like, how weird that is, like, to come visit a set in New York you know, or I don't know if it was like an exterior or what the set was, which one, but he visits them all dressed up. And Polanski, he had sketched out characters of what everybody in the movie, like, to cast them, he had the picture in his head. So he didn't just see random people and go, oh yeah, you're that type. Like, he drew every character out. And so Charles Grodin was one that didn't match the picture that he had in his head. But when he saw him, he's like, oh yeah, that's what I had in mind. So he just went ahead and cast him like that.
That's funny.
And apparently every major role that he hand drew, they found an actor that looked like it, even like with like Ralph Bellamy and like the name actors, it was still like, yeah. That's yeah.
He's like, these are the people really, I'm just gonna draw pictures of them and hope we'll get them.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think the only major concession to the following the book is that Minnie, the Ruth Gordon character, and the book is Midwestern and has a very thick Midwestern accent.
She's got a thick accent, all right.
Yeah. She's got a thick accent, all right.
So let's talk about these neighbors. So they move in and they're introduced to the apartment that backs up to their wall or whatever. On the other side of their wall is these two very bored, you know, what they think of like two old bored neighbors that have nothing better to do than to like just knock on their door constantly. Like, hey, we're not interrupting anything, are we? And like, you know, try this dessert and do this and, you know, just.
So, okay. So here, before we get into, yeah. Does she meet the girl that's living with them first? So they meet them first. And then she meets the girl living with them in the basement.
They meet the girl first. When she's doing her laundry, she meets the girl.
Right. So, okay.
And they plant the necklace and everything. Yeah.
So what was that girl's tie? That's where I could not figure that out.
They were trying to have her have the baby.
They were trying to have her.
She killed herself? Yes. Or they threw her out the window?
No, she killed herself because she figured it out.
I don't know that that's exactly clear.
Really?
Like, there's a lot of back and forth, I think, among people about, did this woman kill herself or did she want to bail and they had her killed and just made it look like a suicide.
That's true. But either way, though, they clearly, like, you can see that they set up Rosemary with the same stuff, with the necklace, with the herbs.
Yes.
They're keeping her around. I mean, they were grooming her before Rosemary.
Okay.
And then for whatever reason, either she figured it out or she just wanted to bail and they needed to cut ties or whatever. But, like, they took care of her, made it look like a suicide or it was a suicide. And then they needed a new surrogate. So that's where Rosemary comes in.
Okay, that makes sense. That's where I was confused. I was like, what are we doing here?
Yeah. But I mean, again, like with the writing, you know, and credit to Ira Levin, like setting it up with the writing and everything. So we're introduced with that necklace, you know, that has the quote-unquote
Tanis root.
That no one's ever heard of because it is a made-up thing.
Yeah, but it's not a thing.
But for the purposes of the movie, it's this magical witch-like property or whatever. But, you know, they set all that up here, which is really cool because you get that through line of like, oh, it smells bad. And everyone's like, what is that? Tanis root. I've never heard of that. And so you can see how she's.
Tanis root is such a great thing because it totally sounds like a thing. Like,
oh, it does. Yeah, absolutely.
It just sounds like a thing that you've never heard of, but it totally sounds real. Like, and that's a difficult thing to do, to create something that is like, sounds like it's of this world that you just maybe have never heard of. Like, that was such a nice touch.
I think there was a podcast called Tanis that got picked up by like Amazon Prime and they made it into a TV show where they would like, and it was just like stories. Like it was just like creepy stories. And like, I think I'm almost positive that's what it was. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
So we meet
the neighbors after she jumps. They find the police are there outside the apartment and they start questioning Rosemary about who this woman is. And she says, oh, you got to find the people they live with. And this is where we meet the neighbors.
And it's very creepy. Like the neighbors are like Tom said, they're very bored and the kind of just old, like high society money, you know. Weirdos is the best way to describe it. The husband is not as weird as the wife.
Well, seemingly.
I mean, seemingly. Yeah, on the surface, right? Initial meeting, they're not as weird.
It's Minnie and Roman Cassavet. And I always found it funny that, like, I'm like, Cassavet, that sounds so close to Cassavetes. Like, yeah. It's just so strange that they chose a name. Or, I mean, they cast actors. Like, I don't know. It's strange that it ends up. But anyway, for whatever reason. But there are these neighbors that, if you're a young couple that is trying to start a family and you've got a career and you're busy with doing your own stuff, you don't want the neighbors that are going to constantly just,
no,
they don't have any work to do. They have nothing to do. They're going to come over and try to invite themselves to dinner and get into your business and all that. So these become those type of neighbors, and they just think they're really annoying people.
And well, yes, you're right. And we also hear at one point, when Rosemary and Guy are sleeping, they hear chanting, and it's like, get out now.
I mean, that's the thing. They're the apartment that's connected to theirs, like on the other side of the wall. So
yeah, they share a wall, I guess.
When they hear some weird stuff going on, it's like, well, it must be coming from there. But then it's like, oh, there's just these two old bored people. Like, well, it must not be them.
Right. And they're right. There's more of them. It's just not the two of them. So Guy is going on auditions, and he loses this part to a guy. And I think they get invited over to dinner with Roman and Minnie. And there's one, you know, it's one of those, I forget. I know I have let on that I know what I'm talking about when I have to recap a movie, but if I haven't seen one in like 20 years there, I forget things. So when you get to the scene where Guy and Roman are sitting on the couch talking to, like, you don't know what they're saying, but it's like, this is it. Like, that's the moment where Rosemary is effed.
Yeah, they draw him in.
Right. Yeah. It doesn't take long. Like, yeah. I have to assume that he's like, I'll give you your career if you give me her. And he was like, okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Where do I sign?
That's what's always interesting. Like, I think I've only seen this once or twice before ever. So it's interesting watching it again, completely knowing what's going on, because you pick up on all those little things. Like, certainly the first time I watched it, I'm not thinking there's anything weird about Guy, you know, until it becomes apparent.
Right, right.
But now you're watching it and you're like, oh God.
He's bad from the jump.
I guess technically, Kevin, he does not become apparent.
Yeah.
But I agree. It's fascinating to watch, and it really holds up on a rewatch, because everything that this movie does, it does in front of you. You mm-hmm. just don't. I mean, it's like a magic trick. You know what I mean?
If you don't know what this movie is, I feel like it's impossible at this point to go into this movie blind.
Yeah,
but I can only imagine what people seeing this for the first time thought when it starts to go.
Absolutely. Because, you know, keep in mind, you're seeing this for the first time in 1968. Is that when this came out? So,
yeah.
I mean, what else? There was nothing in mainstream cinema that had been like that. You know what I mean?
No.
I mean, that's just,
Psycho, right? Like, that's probably as close as you're going to get to that style of.
True, but even then, that's still grounded in reality. It's like there are killers out there. Like, just real quick, because we like to do this on these movies we've been doing, highest grossing films of 1968. So these are the movies that you'd be seeing at the same time as Rosemary's Baby. The Green Berets, John Wayne's Vietnam War movie. The only Hollywood movie made about Vietnam during Vietnam, in case you were curious. The Lion in Winter, Yours, Mine, and Ours, Romeo and Juliet, coming in at tied for number 6, Rosemary's Baby and Planet of the Apes. Number 5, Oliver, Bullet.
Oh, so good.
Number 3 is The Odd Couple. Number 2 is 2001, A Space Odyssey. And number 1 is Funny Girl. So, I mean,
that's a masterclass.
Yeah, and then also you got to figure Mia Farrow is best known for being on a soap opera called Peyton Place. So, like, you go into this movie thinking you're getting, oh, that's the girl that married Frank Sinatra, and she's on that Peyton Place we like.
Yeah,
so much.
She was just, yeah, a soap opera actress. She was Mrs. Frank Sinatra before this, and this really put her on the map. And it's tough to read about it. I almost felt for her like I felt for Rosemary, because she was trying to get out from under that stigma of just being Mrs. Frank Sinatra.
Right.
And then, you know, she takes the role and people are saying, you're sure to get an Oscar nomination for this. And probably win the Oscar, and then she doesn't even get nominated.
How is that possible?
Well, I'll tell you what, I have a theory. I'm not a big conspiracy theorist, but Frank Sinatra told her not to do this movie, and she decided to go ahead and do this movie while their marriage was failing. Frank Sinatra sends her divorce papers, like, to the set, like, while she's working on the movie, and then all of a sudden she doesn't even get nominated. I'm thinking Frank Sinatra pulled some strings, but that's just a conspiracy.
Or Frank Sinatra's people, because let's be honest, the story in The Godfather is Johnny Fontaine is Frank Sinatra.
Right, yeah.
So I'm just saying.
And
that
movie is From Here to Eternity, I believe, is what that's supposed to be.
Oh, really?
I believe so, because that was his big, I think that was the movie that really like put him back as a, you know, as a box office.
So that's just my theory, but when you see that she wasn't even nominated, you're just like, huh? But then you see the backstory. By the way, just an aside, I watched The Godfather again for the first time in a while the other day. God, that's such a good movie.
Which version did you watch?
Just the, like, whatever I have on Vudu, so it's probably theatrical.
Have you ever seen, like, the Coppola Blu-ray remaster?
Well, I have the Godfather trilogy on Blu-ray, and I think that's maybe even where I got the digital versions from. I can't remember, but I don't think I've ever seen anything other than, like, the regular, just theatrical cuts of those movies.
It's much darker in, like, light. Like, I guess his version was much darker as far, not in tone, but, like, he sucked a lot of the light out of it. So it's got this weird, color palette to it.
He didn't. Gordon Willis did. But
Gordon Willis, not Coppola.
Yeah, totally. They had to lighten it when it went to home video, because your TV screen, you know, it was designed to be seen on a big screen so it could be darker, because it was going to be so much larger. And so they had to color correct for that at home.
And now I think all Blu-ray releases have that darker tint to it.
It's always so weird going back and watching people that have been big stars for your entire life, but like to see Robert Duvall so young, like, you know, Robert Duvall. Well, yeah, of course, Pacino just seems like a kid. But, like, to me, like, Robert Duvall is he's the old man, like, the wise old man role. So to see him as, like, a 30-year-old is just, you know what I mean?
A 30-year-old playing a wise old man?
Yeah. It's like when I went back and I watched Midnight Cowboy, which is an amazing movie completely blanked on. But, I mean, seriously, I loved it. I think it's incredible. But to see John Voight is old man Angelina Jolie's dad. Like, to see him young is so weird.
Did you ever see Easy Rider?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've got that one.
I mean, that's what's the bad? Who's the bad? Not the bad guy, but who's the other?
Dennis Hopper? Yeah. To see Dennis Hopper.
Right. Yeah. So
Tom knows all about that. Don't even get him started on that crap.
Oh, yeah, I know. It's like getting me going.
Well, especially because Easy Rider wouldn't exist without the monkeys. So.
I know. That's why.
See, there
so
we
don't.
Go.
That's what I was. I wasn't just saying because you're old. I'm saying because of the monkeys. Yeah.
Now we know, like, after this party, all of a sudden, Guy becomes very interested in having a child.
Like, to the point where
he's got, like, days circled on the calendar, and, you know,
he's got it all mapped out.
He's so focused on having a child, he's tracking his own ovulation.
Yeah, and you
can
tell, like,
most potent.
From their discussion, and you can infer that it's like, yeah, we just moved to this place. My career hasn't taken off. Like, you can tell that his position has been like, we're not ready to start a family. And then when she's like, wait a minute, what? You want to have a kid? And he's like, yeah, you know, I've been thinking about it. And
there is that middle B where all of a sudden the guy who got the part all of a sudden goes blind, and they offer the part to Guy. And then he goes into, let's have a baby.
Which is great, because we know, you know, in retrospect, that, like, the cult made that happen. But before you know that, it makes sense, because it's like, oh, well, now he has he's on a more stable footing. So it's easier to decide to have a family, because now he has this large role in this Broadway production.
And that's where the smart writing.
Yes.
You don't really bat an eyelash. Like, you don't even, like, it never skips a beat. Everything about this movie, like you said, is hidden in plain sight. It's great to go back and watch. But when you're experiencing it for the first time, like, I remembered, you question it. Like, you know something weird is going on, but they constantly set it up to, well, is she quote-unquote crazy? Like, is she?
It's Hereditary, right?
Right.
Like, yeah, totally. Throughout all of Hereditary, you're like, am I seeing these things?
Yeah.
Or are these things actually happening?
That's what makes it great, is they keep you guessing. And so that's why, like, I know it's a horror movie, but also, like I watched this again, and I was, Katie doesn't like horror, thriller, suspense, anything like that, but I almost watched it with her, and she almost agreed to it, because I'm like, but really, until, it's just not that weird until the end. So, like, it's just not traditionally, like, you watch this whole movie kind of more questioning things rather than seeing anything.
Well,
it's
I wouldn't say it's not so weird till the end. You have the insemination scene.
Well, no, there's that one scene in the middle and then the end. But I just mean, like, horror-wise, it's not really, like, there's just not those constant jump scares or violence where, you know, it's, but again, and then even in that scene, it appears as a dream sequence or a nightmare, you know, and so that's where you're still questioning, like, she's questioning. I mean, she wakes up the next day thinking, like, oh, I had a bad dream.
Well,
I mean,
no, she's thinking that he had sex with her. She's thinking that John had sex with her, and she's like, you couldn't have waited till I was, like, sober? And he was like, no, I needed to do it right now. And she's got these claw marks on her side. And it's a scene that I feel like, in any sort of documentary where they talk about, like, the scariest movie, and this is listed as one of the scariest movies of all time.
Yeah.
Just that scene of, like, the devil's eyes.
I think Entertainment Weekly rated it, like, the second scariest.
It should be in the tops. I agree.
Because it's a dream sequence, like, if you don't know what's going on, if you were watching it for the first time, you think it's a really weird dream sequence. And so, like, it sets up, but knowing what's happening, so, like, the old people send over some pudding. Chocolate mousse.
Yeah.
And so, and even the details, like, apparently they're different colors, so Guy knows which one to give her. It's a detail that's in the book that, you know, again, Plansky kept it in the movie. So, but she's eating this, and she says it has a weird taste and aftertaste, and he's like, no, it doesn't, keep eating it, whatever. And then you can tell she's sedated, and he brings her to bed, and then he has this quote, she has a quote unquote dream sequence, but knowing what's happening, it's really creepy because it's like, it looks like, oh, she's going to sailing on a boat. And then it's like, well, let me bring you down below deck, which now we know is like
going to hell
down to this ritual. Yeah. And
oh, see, I took it as she was like going to hell.
Yeah. I mean, I think you
like
can
going below deck.
Right.
Yeah.
You can interpret it that way. But I mean, I think they brought her down to this bed because she goes and lays in a bed. But I mean, she's being raped. Like, knowing that now, when you've seen the movie, it's really uncomfortable. And especially with what Polanski will go on to do, I will say.
Yeah. Right.
It was more disturbing, again, knowing what's happening in the movie and knowing what he does. Like, it's a very difficult scene to rewatch.
Yeah. And it's interesting. We talk about the final girls all the time. And, you know, there's always that one character in the slasher flick that is not exactly one step ahead of the serial, of the killer, but she's smart and she's capable. This is another, like,
that's Hutch.
No, this is kind of her.
Really?
Like, she's eating this mousse and she's like, I don't like it.
Oh, she does get hints.
And
she
dumps it out.
She's got the friend, though, which is another trope of the horror movies.
I love
like,
it.
Like,
yeah,
her
yeah,
friend,
the friend that knows everything.
Her friend Hutch.
She's her Peter Vincent from Fright Night.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So he comes along the way. Like, he warns them about the apartment. It's been known there's some weird stuff and a kid died there and they still go ahead and move in. And then he comes over and eventually, they give her the same necklace that the girl that killed herself had, and he smells it. He's like, oh, what's this? And then the husband is over, Roman's over there, and he's like, oh, it's Tannis root. And he's like, I've never heard of that. I'll have to look into it. And he starts, you know, digging where he shouldn't be, or, you know, and so he's the one that's kind of figuring things out and trying to advise her. Like, he's like, he calls her later when Roman's not there, or at least, you know, calls her on the phone. And he's like, yeah, meet me at this time, this place, because he's doing his own digging and he knows.
Well,
something.
Also, yeah, he's at the apartment, and like you said, he has that interaction with Roman and Guy, And Hutch is like, I'm going to bounce. Yeah. I'm going to get the hell out of here. So he goes to look for his, when he doesn't find his other glove, I was like, oh, Hutch, I'm going to, you were a good character, my friend. We're never going to see you again.
Yeah. Because that's so, when you know, you realize that when, and I think, again, I don't know if it's something that comes from the real life or if it's a movie trope, but when there's anything to do with satanic cults, they need an object to curse or whatever. Like they steal one of your objects. And so if you know that, or that's in the back of your mind and you see things are missing, it's bad news.
Bad news bears. Yeah. So she goes to this meeting to meet Hutch, and of course Hutch isn't there. So she calls his office, and the woman's like, "Yeah, he took ill. He didn't die, but he just took ill." And then they, So we should say, as we're like at this point, she's pregnant and she's looking awful, like worse and worse and worse.
She's so pale.
Is feeding her these like weed drink, and weed is in like not the marijuana, but like these drinks that are basically just all of these plants ground up, and she's drinking it because they think it's like, you know, they tell her that it's Saperstein says it's okay. Who's this doctor, this OB doctor that all like high society, these people from this cult are telling her they're okay. Like, this is who you should go to. He delivered so-and-so's baby. You'll be great. And so she's drinking all this crap. She's losing weight when she should not be losing weight.
Saperstein's telling her not to take any of like the vitamins that her doctor recommended. It's all their hand-picked homegrown herbs and remedies.
Right.
So she's not getting the proper nutrition. She's only getting the crap that is good for what they're doing.
Right.
I also took it as whatever's growing inside of her is essentially a parasite and sucking the life out of her.
Yes. Which is kind of what a baby does anyway.
Sure, yeah.
Like, no offense to the mothers that are listening, but that's kind of what a baby does. This one is a different level, obviously. Yeah. So Mia Farrow is, I feel like at this, she's always kind of been this smaller woman in stature, fairly thin, big eyes. Like, she's just a smaller woman. So when they doubled down on like putting like dark bags under her eyes and making her look even smaller, mm-hmm. like there's just something very uncomfortable about looking at her in that state. And then I'm trying to think, is it when Hutch dies and she gets the book and she starts putting it together that she says she wants to have a party with just her friends? Is
yes,
that right?
I think so. I think it's in that order. Yeah. Like, but yeah. So
and she doesn't want the old folks to come. No older people.
Yeah. She's catching on. Like you said, I mean, ever since the moose thing and everything that's going on, she's putting the clues together. Hutch's like last action was to give his book to his assistant. He's like circling things. And when she gets it, the last thing that she tells Rosemary is that it's an anagram, right?
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
And so she has to figure out, she takes the book and she's like, is it the title of the book? But there's stuff circled inside of it and there's names. And so that's where she starts putting together that there's a name circled in there that's like the leader of the satanic cult is Stephen Mercado. And when she gets out her Scrabble pieces and she puts them together, that's an anagram for Roman Castevet.
Right.
So
I thought it was the sun.
What's that?
I thought it was Castevet's Roman son. I thought that Roman was the son of this guy, but if they're saying that Roman is the leader of it.
No, I think he was the son. Like this guy in the book, because it's like an old book, he was the leader. But now, I mean, Roman's an old guy, but he's the leader now. I'm guessing he took over and has been the leader since his dad died.
Right. So they have this party, and this is we talk about everyone who is surrounding Rosemary. In Rosemary's life are in this cult and have joined this cult. And then she is surrounded by women who are her friends, who are just like, you need to go to the doctor. Yeah. Like, this is not okay. Like, you are not supposed to be losing weight. You're not supposed to be having this much pain. And, they're starting to get through to her, and Rosemary is starting to build up some confidence. And she tells John or Guy, that's it. Like, I'm done with these people. I'm going to see Dr. Hill. And John starts to freak out. Sorry, Guy, John Cassavetes. Guy starts to like double down on the asshole husband. Like, you're not going to that doctor. You're going to this doctor. You're doing what I'm going to tell you to do. You're not going to see these people anymore.
Well, because we know that he knows what's at stake here. He owes everything in his career and has promised, you know, that he will make her do all these things. They said, take these things, see this doctor, and eventually have this baby that will figure out what's going on with it. And so, yeah, he's going to freak out when she starts saying, right. Yeah, I'm done with them. I don't want to see them, and I'm going to go see Dr. Hill.
And he's like, no, you know, does the whole thing. And
yeah,
all of a sudden, I don't know if it's the gestational period of this demon child or what, but all of a sudden this pain that she has been complaining about stops. And it just goes away. And
she can feel the baby, right? Was this the point? Like, she wasn't feeling him, and then she can feel him?
Yeah, like, yes. Like her pain stops, and then she instantly is like, oh, I can feel a move. And she even says to Guy, like, oh, feel it, feel the baby kick. Yeah. And he's like, no, I'm good.
No, thank you. So now that she stopped taking the drinks, she won't, you know, now they're, Minnie's coming over there with, like, milk and some weird cake, which I'm sure was full of other demon property things.
So she goes to Dr. Hill to try to get
help.
Well,
so she gets like a book on witchcraft, and she's reading, like, everything starts to click for Rosemary, that something, the dream that she thought was a dream was not a dream. So
she also appears, and this would be like, this is like the modern day equivalent of like Believe Women, right? Like, she also people are like, she sounds like a crazy person, and we know she isn't.
She does, though, right? Like,
but like, if a person is going around saying witches and the demons and satanic cults, like, you're gonna be like, you might need to get some help. Like, we know what's going on, but
it's similar to the Invisible Man that just came out, right?
Yes.
Like,
oh yeah,
where she's just like, he's invisible and he's out to get me, even though he's dead. And like, even her friend gives her this look of like, I did not realize that's why we called this meeting.
Right. It's the old I'm not crazy, but here's this crazy thing going on.
Yeah.
Right. So she does. She goes back to see Dr. Hill, and she explains everything to him. And he's like,
Let's
go
here.
Put you in this room. I'll turn on, we'll get you some rest. It'll be great. Can I see those books real quick?
Well, like, he's basically like, yeah, can we go, do you want to go stay at, you know, this facility?
Oh, yeah, he's at Mount Sinai, which I thought was like a rehab facility. And I was like, oh, geez, like, let's not do
to
that.
To get her help. Is that a place for women, like sheltered women, or is it like a rehab facility?
I thought it was a rehab facility.
No, I think it's just a really good hospital.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
So he's like, yeah, just wait here. And she like takes a nap on the couch. Yeah. And she wakes up, and it's the old gang here. And he is called Saperstein. He got Guy together, and they're coming to
I didn't take this as he was part of the cult as much
I don't think Dr. Hill is. I think Dr. Hill is like, she needs help. And like,
how I took it as well, that he was not part of the cult, but he ends up inadvertently being an enabler because he trusts authority, right? Like, this Abe Saperstein is like a very, very well-known and respected OBGYN.
Right.
And Hutch says that, her friend.
Yeah.
Like, Hutch is like, he delivered my grandchildren. So Saperstein is the highest society well-known, and so Dr. Hill, even though he's not in the cult, is like, yeah, I know Saperstein is this respected guy, and he's treating her like she needs his help.
Yeah. And just real quick, founded in 1852, the Mount Sinai Hospital is one of the nation's largest and most respected hospitals, acclaimed internationally for excellence in clinical care, ranked among the top hospitals nationwide. This is that's from their own website, though, so take that as you will.
Okay.
So they get her home, and this was the best. Like, this jump scare is on the level of the jump scare in Exorcist 3.
Mm-hmm.
Like, where she's got her back to, she's calling her friend to get her out. Like, you know, she's basically saying, get me the flip out of here. And,
the phone booth scene?
As she's got her back to this the hallway, you see like two male bodies quickly dart behind her. And it was super effective. Like, I was watching it in the dark because I'm that kind of idiot. And jump scares like that. And I don't think there's really like the high pitched clang or music cue that we get now. It was very subtle, yeah. But it was very unnerving. Mm-hmm. Much like the jump scare in Exorcist 3, where like the gal gets decapitated. So now this is the moment where she realizes nobody's on her side, because Saperstein injects her with like a sedative, and Guy is right there next to him. She wakes up and the baby's gone. Like, she's had the baby, and Guy's sitting there, and there's almost like this moment of, oh my God, it was all a nightmare. Like, what the hell? And then she realizes, oh, it wasn't a nightmare
there's
at all.
One of the women is next to her, and she's like, where
oh,
is
right,
it?
Right, right.
Where's the baby? And she's like,
she
let
was
me
like,
go
I'll be
get...
right back.
Yeah.
So
Saperstein tells her, he says that there were complications, and if I was at
the
hospital,
dead.
Like he's like, you wouldn't let me go take you to the hospital. So now,
right. It's that he's gaslighting her. Like, there's so much of what we see today happening in this movie that gives this another level of uncomfortability.
Sure. Yeah.
Because you believe, as viewers, we're like, you're on her side. So when the doctor's like, you wouldn't let me do it, you wouldn't let me do that, you're like, you lying bastard. Mm-hmm. Like, we know what you did. So they keep trying to give her these pills, which I assume are sleeping pills, and she stops taking them. She's like sneaking them, you know, she like puts them in like this little hole in her bed frame.
Like bookcase.
And finally,
or something.
Yeah, finally she gets up.
She
hears the baby crying. That's right.
Yeah.
She gets up, she goes to that closet, and she realizes that there's a way to get into the other apartment from this closet. And
it's like really like, dark, but you see a pinhole of light coming through it.
So why did the other woman block it?
I just think to have a
why
secret.
Why did she block that closet?
I think it was just like a secret connection to where she could go back and forth. But I mean,
but she was an old woman. She couldn't move that chest.
No, I think that they put that probably in front of the wall, but I'm guessing that was like a temporary wall put up. But yeah, I think the chest, the bureau, whatever thing was put there maybe by
like
the
realtor, the people renting the apartment.
Oh.
Like, they were like, hide that this access point, which
exactly.
is why
okay.
they could tell it had been moved because they hadn't cleaned properly.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
Like, what? Yeah, so was it moved by the resident?
Right. So she goes in, and there is everybody and the one Asian guy.
Yeah.
I don't know why that guy's there. Like,
yeah.
I think to show like the worldwide, like,
we haven't seen,
like the,
I guess that makes sense. Yeah.
That's how I took it. But the fact that they have him taking the pictures is a bit much, but especially with yeah. modern eye. But
right.
But I interpreted it the same way, that this was their way of saying that, like, this is a worldwide organization.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Like, people are coming from all over the world to be a part of this because they've got their transplanted, whatever, all across the world. And, but yeah, she sees guys there, which is of course very
yeah.
disturbing, that he's sitting there as she's sedated in bed. He's there partying and yucking it up with all these.
It is weird. Cause if you watch that again, Guy gets up and like, and when she walks around the corner, he was like, oh, I gotta go.
Yeah.
Like, he gets up and walks away. And, like, tries to hide his face. And then when, like, finally she sees him off in, like, the closet or whatever, she's like, what are you doing? So there's been this underlying theme that God is dead. It was on, like, the cover of, like, a Time Life magazine. And this kind of becomes the mantra.
That's a real magazine cover, by the
yes,
way.
Yes. Right. Was it Life or Time?
No, it was that. It was Time. It was, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, God is dead, or is God dead or something like that. Yeah.
And that becomes their mantra at this point, where they basically tell her, like, yeah, that was real. Like, the person that you had sex with was the devil.
they flip a switch, because the entire movie, they keep you questioning, like, is she imagining things? Are these people her friends? They're gaslighting her. They're lying to her. We know, but, you know, you're just not quite sure. But now that she's done what they need her to do, they're just like,
there's no reason to hide it.
Yeah, it goes crazy. Like, they're all
yeah.
just like yelling things at her, and it's nuts.
I love I think one of my favorite parts is where she says something like, oh my God. And the one lady's like, oh, enough of your God stuff.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
She looks into the crib. There's like this bassinet, black bassinet with like black lace covering it. And they're like, go look at your baby. And of course she goes over there and she looks at him and
she's like, what's wrong with his eyes?
His eyes. And, you know, I guess they kind of say that he's got got hooves.
She says, makes a reference to his hands and feet looking weird, and then she's like, what's wrong
like,
with
look
his
at
eyes?
They go, look at his hands and look at his feet.
And then she's like, oh my God. This is the line that Tom's like, for the gal's like, give it a rest with the oh my God, will you?
Yeah.
So she sits down and she has a moment where the woman who was sitting next to her bed is like, apparently never raised a child before and is rocking the crap out of that baby. And Rosemary's like, you're rocking him too hard. And she was like, shut up. Like, go sit. She's like this. She's the meanest of them all. Like,
yeah.
This woman
is totally crazy. She's just.
Yeah. So finally,
Roman comes over. Doesn't he say, like, go take care of your baby. Join us. Like, you don't have to even be a part of this, but like, take care of your baby. Do what you're supposed to do. And
he kind of says, he's like, she wants him to breastfeed. Yeah. That's what she wants him to do. And she won't do it. And she's like, the other women are too old.
Yeah,
he won't.
Because
they've
been stealing her milk. Like,
right.
You know,
right,
like
right,
there's
right.
that moment where you realize they're stealing her milk, which is very creepy.
And then I don't know if they hand her, but she starts like the song that is being. Does she walk
she
over
just walks
to the
over to the bassinet and it ends. Yeah. Like, yeah.
But she starts humming that song. Like, there's a song that's being hummed by
the lullaby.
The lullaby in the beginning of the movie that already, like, that to me already put you in a sense of uncomfortability. Like, just the way it's very soft.
It's a waltz, I believe.
Well, it worked. And then she starts humming it again. So you're left to assume that she has joined the cult.
Or at least decided to stay and raise her baby.
Well, we'll find out in part
two. You have to find out what happened to Rosemary's baby.
Yeah, that's how it ends. This is a brilliant movie.
Yeah,
like,
they
despite all of the creative processes and the creators behind it, this is a brilliant piece of cinema.
Yeah, the studio originally wanted there to be an actual, like, you see a creepy baby, and they were, you know, Polanski was like, no, we're not going to do that. And boy, he made the right call, because the reveal on that would never live up to what's in your head. And then the technical limitations of that day, there's a really good chance that it would just end up almost being comical and then undercut everything that came before it. So they were very smart to not do that.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe you end it with like a cute baby, you know, like that's what Damien was.
Yeah.
Damien was like this cute kid and it was like, oh, okay, it's bad.
No, I like it. I agree. I think it's great that, you know, better left to the imagination. You're sitting there wondering what this horrific, you know, creature is. And then what is Rosemary going to do?
Wait, isn't that kind of the premise of The Omen?
What, that it's
isn't everybody surrounding Gregory Peck and his wife? Like, aren't they all?
Like, yeah, I mean, this cultists? This kicked off like a whole rash of like satanic cult movies. So you got Brotherhood of Satan, Mark of the Devil, Black Noon, Blood on Satan's Claw, Omen, of course.
Ooh.
So you got a lot of this after. A lot of people started going down this rabbit hole a lot. Before we wrap up, I want to take one moment to talk about the elevator operator in this film.
Okay.
So it's just an interesting little side note. He's played by an actor named Derville Martin, and he's the elevator operator in the building, and he would end up being played by Wesley Snipes.
What?
Yes, Wesley Snipes, the elevator operator in this film is the character that Wesley Snipes plays in Dolomite Is My Name. That's his claim to fame of being a Hollywood actor to get into Dolomite and work on that film, was that he had been in a big Hollywood movie and this is the person that he is playing.
That's hilarious.
So I just thought that was too good of a footnote to not point out.
Absolutely.
That's
so
great.
I just wanted to draw everyone's attention to that. So coming up on the next one, we will tackle the made-for-TV non-classic Look What's Happened to Rosemary's Baby. So until then, let's go around the table and everyone can say where to find them.
This is Joe. You can follow me on the Twitter at JoeyButts, B-U-T-T-S-21.
This is Kevin. Follow me on Twitter at Kevin R. Brackett.
And this is Tom. You can follow me on Twitter at Roger Kubert or on Facebook at Facebook.com/Tom O'Keefe. Find the show online, Facebook.com/Real Spoilers. While you're there, like the page, join the group, and of course, check out our Patreon, Patreon.com/Real Spoilers. So that's it for this one. Coming up next, look what happened to Rosemary's Baby. Until then, thanks for tuning in, and Abby's sacrifice is approved of by Jesus.
Deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.